going to want to read and won't be able to. We found a pair of glasses over there. Oh, here we go. Thank goodness. I don't know. Secondly, we are missing a wristwatch. Rolex?
No.
There's a gentleman who needs his wristwatch back, so get it back in all honesty. If not, call your sponsor right away. Well, I'm going to turn over, open the procession. We've got the notice call you.
Good morning, my name is Bill. I'm a recovering compulsive overeater. And I'm going to make Ken Short work of the theme today and then talk about what I really want to talk about, which is the steps. Here's what we promised. From page 83 of the big book. You all know this. If we are painstaking about this phase of our development, we will be amazed before we're halfway through. We're going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We will not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. We will comprehend the word serenity and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. Interesting to see what's in these promises and what isn't in these promises. What is in these promises is the ability, through working steps, has come to at the end of the discussion of the ninth step in the big book, on our lives. We will have major changes that will go on in our lives as a result of working steps. Does it say we will stop drinking? This is a book about alcoholism. Doesn't say that. Does it say we'll stop compulsive overeating? Does it say that our lives will be wonderful? That we will get everything we want? It says that our lives will markedly improve and that we will be better able to live our lives as a result of working steps. And so, if you want to talk to me about food and about physical recovery, I have opinions about that. I'll be glad to talk to you about it. You know, I know some of you may have come up because of that theme. Love to talk about it one-on-one or in a small group if you want to do that. But I don't think that's what the program is about. I think the program, in fact, it says in the beginning of the big book that the whole purpose of the steps is to have a spiritual experience. And the promises are what happen as a result of the spiritual experience. So we have a spiritual experience, our lives change, we're better able to handle our lives, and we have a better perspective on who we are and what we're doing that's messing up our lives, our compulsive eating. So, what I think I need to tell you then is that it's important to work steps. And that's, as you heard my story last night, that was the thing that impressed me when I walked into that first meeting 30 years ago, was the man had worked the steps. And he knew the steps inside and out. And he could talk about what he'd done. So what I'd like to do with my time is to go through the steps. And to talk about my perspective on them, how, in my experience, I've worked some of the things that I've encountered along the way. And some of the things that I've encountered in working with other people who've also worked the steps. So I'm going to do steps 1, 2, and 3 this morning. I'll do steps 4 through 9 this afternoon, and I'll do steps 10 through 12 tomorrow morning. And we'll go through in order on that. So let's start with my favorite step, the one that I continue to resist working. We admitted we were powerless over food, that our lives have become unmanageable. As I said, admitting that I was powerless over food was easy. It was very clear to me that my food, my eating was out of control. I would particularly have problems at dinner, and it was at the end of a long and stressful day. I would come home. I had bought a house in this small town in Ohio where I live, and I wasn't really feeling very happy because I didn't have very many friends, and I was working all the time, and I was feeling very stressed out. I was feeling like my career was not advancing the way I wanted it to advance, and I was worried that I was going to be stuck in this small town forever. Nothing did come up, and I was also worried about not having friends and not having anyone to date. I thought that, and this was before I figured out I was gay. This is when I was still trying to date women. And I would go out on dates with women, and they would be very chaste dates. They would be, you know, having women as friends or trying to do that. The women clearly wanted something more. But I wasn't there, you know. And a lot of it was the fact that I was so wrapped up in myself. It wasn't necessarily that I was fat, although I felt I was fat. I always had a very negative body image for myself. Even when I looked relatively good, I had a negative body image for myself. It was like, I know I'm not going to be sexually appealing. And I'm still not quite sure where that all comes from. I've, you know, done some therapy and I've worked on it, and the therapist wants to keep thinking that I was molested somehow, but I wasn't, that I can remember. You know, I was probably under some kind of ongoing psychological attack out of the relationship between my alcoholic father and my very controlling, codependent mother. And that rubbed off, and it probably, I can see that that's probably the case in my family. My brother is also gay and is also single, and has never been able to be in a relationship either. And he was 8 years younger than me. He's the youngest in the family. And my two sisters have confided in me when I've talked about some of these things that even though they're in happy marriages of more than 20 years apiece, that sex has always been a problem for them as well. So I'm not quite sure how, you know, all of that worked out in my family. I just know that it was undoubtedly a family dynamic that contributes to it. So I had turned my attention to work, and I'd had all the trappings of somebody who was successful. I owned a nice home that I could fix up in a nice neighborhood and really make into something that I wanted. And, you know, things were going along well in my job. It looked like I was going to be doing well, but I didn't want to be there. I didn't want to live in this town. I didn't want this job. I didn't want the life that I had. And I would come home from work, and I would start to prepare dinner. And I knew what I should be eating, but basically I'd walk in the door and immediately feel hungry. And so I'd start eating as I was preparing dinner. And essentially I ate the dinner while I was preparing the other dinner. And then what I would do is it'd be all done. And I'd say, I gotta sit down and eat this. So I'd sit down and, you know, like a good boy, I was trained to clean the plate. You know, my parents grew up with the Depression, and you didn't waste anything. So I eat second dinner. And then I go sit down on the couch to watch the news, and I feel tired, and I feel listless, and I end up lying down on the couch and passing out. And, you know, and being there for a while, and waking up feeling awful about myself. That was probably the height of my disease. Right at that point, that was the most major symptoms of what I was doing. So when I got to the doctor, getting this food plan, it meant that I had to stick to things. I not only had to not eat sugar, but I also had to make every effort to do my eating in a healthy manner. And OA helped me do that. And in fact, the group of newcomers I was in, that's what they wanted to obsess about, was talking about food. So it was pretty easy to skip over the fact that my life had become unmanageable. The trappings were not unmanageable. The food was the problem. And I could be in denial. I grew up in a family where denial was a big part of our family system, particularly around my father's alcohol. And so consequently, I could be in denial if the rest of my life was unmanageable. Now somehow, deep inside me, I knew it wasn't. I figured getting out of there was the answer, and so I was looking to get out of there, which is how come I ended up in Minneapolis. But it was still pretty easy for me to go through and say that it's not managed, that it is manageable, and that really the food is just the problem. But that goes against the idea of having of the steps becoming something that is a spiritual experience. That's why it was easy for me to skip over step two and step three and try to jump directly to the inventory. That I didn't think, I thought the spiritual part was just something that you had to do. It was, you know, some group of Christians who ended up, because you read the big book and it's got a very Christian overtone to it. So, you know, it was just some group of Christians who took some of their Christian theology and were trying to apply it to OA. Since become convinced that was not the case. So they may have been a group of Christians, but they were taking, they had done some really extensive study and they were taking principles from a number of different religious traditions and attempting to blend them together to talk about, well, how do you achieve a spiritual experience? Well, in many religious traditions, the way to achieve a spiritual experience is letting go. Letting go and letting God in. And the only way we can let God in is to be powerless. It's one of the great paradoxes of the program. You become powerful by being powerless. And I could do that at my OA meetings. I could do that in context of work with the program. I could say, so somehow, even though I didn't personally want to admit that my life was unmanageable, somehow the program worked anyway. But I could go into that meeting and talk about the food, and I'd listen to the mostly other women. I think I was still the only man in the room. Most of the women in the room talking about what they were eating and what kind of diet to follow. And of course, we had gray sheet and we had orange sheet and we had blue sheet. Was it blue sheet too? No, it was orange sheet, I know. Gray sheet and orange sheet, which they got through the literature. But I already had my food plan, you know, the doctor already did. So I didn't worry about any of that stuff. I didn't get involved in it. You know, really never did, and all those great debates about whether the gray sheet was really healthy for you or not, you know, were going on. So I think I was lucky in the sense that even though I had trouble letting go completely, I let go enough. And I think that's what happens with the program. I think we let go enough, and then we get to move on. And then we get let go a little more. We get to move on. I think one of the great things that I see happening with people when they walk in the door is that oftentimes they're very aware of all the stuff that's crushing down on them. They're very aware of all the problems that they have. And they want to get it solved. And they want to solve it all at once. And so they want to go to extremes. You know, I want to starve myself so that I lose weight fast. I want to, you know, do this, that, and the other thing. So, I really want to get this all done at once. Well, I was like that too. You know, I said I thought I'd work the steps for about a year and then I'd be done and I wouldn't have to go to the OA anymore and, you know, it would be fine. And little did I realize that, yeah, I am a very compulsive person and I need to keep coming back to the program because I need to keep being reminded of the fact that I don't want to let go of these things. So, So I think the way the program works is that it's subtle. We get to recover to the extent that we're willing to let a power greater than ourselves work in our life. And if we're only willing to let the power work in our life a little bit, we recover a little bit. But even that little bit is a start. If we keep coming back, the little bit becomes bigger and bigger and bigger. You know, looking back on it, I knew I was gay. I knew I was going to have to deal with that. I knew that I had problems with being afraid of sex. I knew I was going to have to deal with that. There was absolutely no way when I walked in the door that I could have done that. If you had told me you have to face these issues and you have to work through them, I would have turned around and walked back out the door again and gone to Weight Watchers, where they talk about physical recovery and they emphasize that. I was in no way ready to face that. It was because that meant going against my parents who had inculcated in me that I was not to be gay. And that was the last thing in the world they wanted. And that they had standards for who I was supposed to marry. And that I had better do that and produce grandchildren for them. You know? And my mother even told me one time when I brought when there was a woman I was dating in Ohio, and I came out to California to see my parents, and she, I think probably arranged to do this. She arranged to come through California at the same time. And she came for a visit, and my mother didn't like her immediately. And she was like, this is competition. Harlan talked about being his mother's husband at age 3. I was probably in very much the same situation. And my mother needed comfort. She realized, I think, very early on, she married my father after knowing him less than 6 months. When he came back from World War II. She was anxious to get married. She was 28 years old. Women at that time, 28 years old, was in danger of being an old maid. And she did not want that. Many of her friends were getting married, and that's what she wanted for her life. And so she picked my father. And I think realized, probably even before they actually got married, that she made a mistake. But by the time she got married, she was pregnant with me. And I think she knew it. And she ended up staying with my father until he died. But she needed something else. And I became her something else. And then she made a pattern of that. And I wanted to do that with all of her children. And with varying degrees of success, as it turned out. So yeah, if I was faced with all that right at the beginning, you would do, no, I'd turn around and go out the door. But all it says is, go ahead and put that powerless over for you. And if I can even sort of accept that my life has become unmanageable, at least unmanageable enough that I need a program, then I can make a start. And I can start down that path to try to figure out what. So the second step says that came to believe. So it's a process. That our power, a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. It's not like that we walk through the door with a belief. It's we walk through the door and then eventually we came to believe that there was a power greater than ourselves. And we had to come to believe somehow. And the way the Big Book talks about it, if you read the stories, if you read A Vision for You, is that the way we come to believe is to tell each other stories. If you look at how Bill W. persuaded Dr. Bob to start the first AA meeting, he went to his hospital bed and he told him his story. And Dr. Bob was pretty resistant for a while. Bill kept going back. He kept telling him his story. And finally when Dr. Bob relented, and they'd been meeting for a little while. They knew they needed to go find somebody else, so they went to a hospital bed again and found AA number 3, who was in the hospital bed, and told them their stories. And he said, "You know, I've done that too. You guys may have something here. And what they found out, what Bill W. kept emphasizing, was it's our stories that heal us. It's knowing that there are other people out there who share our stories. I've been so blessed by people coming up to me and saying, you know, when you said that, that was my story. They say if you come back long enough, they'll hear your story. I heard my story many years ago in the San Fernando Valley. It was somebody who came from another area to speak at a meeting, and I never saw him again, but told my story. And I wish I'd been able to connect with him further. But, you know, I went up and talked to him afterwards, but you know, there wasn't any personal connection there. It was interesting to tell my story, but you know, there just wasn't anything there when we talked. So we identify by coming and listening to each other's stories and connecting with that, and then realizing that in the stories, it's themselves is a power greater than ourselves. We couldn't recover on our own. We couldn't recover just simply by writing our story down. An inventory is useful, but it's not useful unless you give it away. We'll talk about that. It's actually confronting another person who has the same disease and talking about it is what helps us. It's the miracle of this program. Bill had gone to psychiatrists. He did in all kinds of things. He talked to professionals. He told them his story many times, but it didn't work until he told another drunken story. And so that's where we get our spiritual strength. That there is a power greater than ourselves, and it is in the stories. It's what we say to each other. You know, God speaks through other people. I'm convinced of that. I'm sure you've all heard the story that Bobby Earl loved to tell about the two drunks in the bar in Alaska, and one was saying, you know, I just don't believe in God, and the other one said, well, why not? And he says, well, I tell you, I was out in the wilderness, and I was lost, and I couldn't find my way out, and I prayed to God to help me. I got down on my knees and said, you know, please, God, get me out of this. And the other guy says, well, you're sitting here, you know, obviously something happened, you were saved, what happened? And he said, oh, you know, some Eskimo came along and shoved me away out. So it's, you know, God speaks through other people to us. So there have been many, many people who've been my Eskimos, and part of my job is to listen to those people and try to hear the voice of God in those people. Try to hear a power greater than myself. So just going to meetings, we connect with those stories. And in doing that, we're starting down the path to working the steps. We're starting to realize that there is a power greater than ourselves that can restore us to sanity. And of course, in order to restore us to sanity, we have to admit that we're insane. Well, that's a load of work. You know, I didn't want to admit that I was insane. I had a food problem. And I also had a God problem. It's like, you know, if God is going to be this power greater than myself, I don't know that I really want to do that. You know, most of us have had some kind of negative experience with God, I think. I think that's one reason why we end up having the disease we do, because we've had some kind of negative experience that's taken us away from having a spiritual power in our lives. And I wouldn't say that's universal, but I'd say a lot of us have had that. And so we're very suspicious about the concept of God. You know, one of my sponsees is a minister, and you know, we think the minister is all set in terms of the God concept. Now, this person has the most problems with step two, because his concept of God didn't work with what he thought he had to have in order to work the program. And so he struggled for at least a year, probably even more, on the concept of the second step. And I'm just not ready to take the second step. And part of the reason that we're not ready to take the second step is we worry about what the third step is going to be. Turning our will and our lives over to this thing. You know? But the third step has an interesting word in it. We made a decision, first of all. It's just the action is making a decision. Very small thing to do. Not a big thing. made a decision to turn our will and our lives, now that's a big thing, okay, over to the care of God as we understood God. You know, my image of God was the person with the long beard on the throne, you know, with all the angels surrounding and sitting in judgment, you know, handing down the Ten Commandments to Moses and saying, "Thou shalt not," all the time. Okay? My image of God was actually my father. And when I really sat down and thought about it, it was my father kept saying, "Thou shalt not," to me, all as I was growing up. And I was rebellious against that. And my father would punish me on a regular basis, sometimes physically. Usually not enough to break the skin or anything like that, but you know, he would punish me so that it hurt. So that he knew so that I would know who was in charge. And I thought that God was punishing me with my compulsive overeating, so that I would figure out that God was in charge. And you know, I'd be damned if I'm going to turn my will and my hope over to that. You know, and have some other kind of representation of my father continuing to tell me that I'm a bad person. Well, the step doesn't say that. Step says that we turn our will and our lives over to the care of God. Which means we've got to have a concept of God that cares about us. I really thought my father didn't care about me much. I thought he cared that I would turn out the way he wanted me to turn out. You know, that I would look good, that I would be good at sports, and that I would make a good marriage, produce good grandchildren, and I would be successful in business. Okay, well, none of those things happened. I looked bad. I was terrible at sports. I was always picked last for the teams. I was afraid of sex, and I didn't want to go into business. I ended up going into teaching. Oh, you know, what did I? I went completely against my father. I didn't want to make the decision to go into teaching either because I knew that would be completely disappointing to him. That would be like the end of it. So, God's like that, how can I turn my will and my life over to that? You know, what I have to do is to realize somehow that there was care out there for me. And I think that's what happened to me in Minneapolis when I got to OA and realized that there were people who were recovering, and it wasn't just sitting around talking about what they were eating this week and whether this was correct in terms of an abstinence or not. They were actually talking about working the steps and trying to understand the steps better. And they were talking about caring for each other. They were talking about reaching out to each other and making phone calls and doing the tools of the program, and letting other people know that telling their stories in an honest way and letting other people know that they care. And so if we have that kind of care in our lives, then it becomes easy to say, okay, I'm going to let somebody else care for me. But that is another paradox. It's, I was taught that I was supposed to take care of myself. I was taught that I was supposed to be very self-sufficient. And I learned to be self-sufficient. But look at where it got me. It got me to eating two dinners at night and going and sleeping on the couch. So I needed to have something in my life that would care for me. And what I realized at the time that I did the third step was that there were people there. And that's all it took. It just took making that simple decision to let something else care for me. And not have to try to do it all myself. And if we can have a concept of God that is, God cares for me. God tries to find ways of helping me. God tries to find ways of doing good things in my life. That's all it takes. That's all it takes to start. So the steps are incremental. We don't have to work on all of our problems at once. Work on them a little bit at a time. All we need is the concept of God is that God cares for us. And then we just have to make a decision to let God do that. And we work the first two steps. Doesn't mean that you don't have to go back and work on all those problems. Yeah, You do. I did. You know, I had to go back and face every single one of those things. Or this program ultimately isn't going to work. But at the very beginning, that's all it takes. And a lot of people, in my experience, make a lot bigger deal of that than probably is needed. So let me stop with that, and we'll come back in the afternoon, and I'll talk about how we get deeper into the program.
Take five before we start again. Let's take five and let's go to the bathroom or do what we need to do.